Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
The Speakeasy is produced by Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station devoted to all things food and beverage. Help keep HRN alive by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click the beating heart to donate. Do it now, and I'll live.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil's grooving them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. Along with me is...
My name is Souther Teague.
There he is. All right. It's a beautiful day in Brooklyn and...
Hot.
It's hot. It is very hot. You've only had water today. I'm on my second beer, dude.
Well, I gotta work.
Yeah, well, you know, this... Yeah, we're working right now. Okay, if you even call it that. It is a pleasure to have our guest in today. There's a really amazing vermouth company based out of, the offices are in Red Hook, and they just recently expanded to a farm, and I think it's...
Welcome, really, Bianca.
Yeah, we got it.
From Uncouth Vermouth.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So, yeah, you're doing some expansion. You've taken over a farm, big farm, upstate.
It's not big, but it is upstate. It's 16 acres, but a lot of it is forest, so which is great for a forager. And then I have a handful of acres of meadow where I've planted around 50 different edible species so far. And we're putting in a cherry orchard, some quince and fig trees and pawpaws and persimmon and all kinds of awesome, delicious fruits.
Everything you're planting is you're aiming towards making into vermouth?
For the most part, I mean, like a different array of aperitifs and digestifs.
Awesome. Your history involves some botanical, right? Do you have a horticulture background?
Sort of. I grew up with a mother who is a plant whisperer, and we would grow a lot of our fruits and vegetables just in our backyard growing up, and we would go hiking and, you know, point out different plants and things. And then I sort of got really into it when I moved back to New York in 2009 because I was kind of going crazy from being stuck in the city all the time.
When did you, like, okay, so first of all, when did you make your first batch of vermouth?
In 2011.
Okay. And was your goal with that to, I mean, were you like kicking around the cocktail world first and foremost and thought that was a good idea, something that needed to be made for the market and for the different bars? Or was it something that you just thought was such a cool, unique ingredient that it should be kind of like drunk on its own? Where was your direction with that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that kind of came later. At first, I was making vermouth just for some cocktail pop-ups, and I was making vermouth just like everybody else. I was using sugar and citrus and vanilla and all kinds of shit that grows nowhere near here. But the irony is I have, you know, a winemaking background and a sustainable winemaking background. And so I, you know, decided to combine my love of foraging and see if it were possible to come up with an actual vermouth, like a real vermouth that is made with ingredients that are in season and they're not pelletized and not extracts and without using sweeteners and, you know, approaching it from like a winemaker point of view rather than like a cocktail mixer. Mm-hmm.
But you're kind of mixing a cocktail in a bottle, right?
I think of vermouth that way always. Yeah, yeah. It's already sort of a cocktail.
Yeah, I mean, fortified wine, I guess, if that's the case, then you could look at sherry as a cocktail.
Absolutely.
You know, pour it as its own cocktail. I mean, I think that it's, you know, squares and rectangles.
It's kind of like, you know, when you have like a cronut, you know, you've got a pastry over here and a pastry over here, and they're two pastries, but then you make them into another pastry. That's what, like, mixing, you know, like your sherry and your vermouth together, the bamboo, is basically two different cocktails
that already stand on their own.
Stand on their own, and you're mixing together.
Well, I mean, anciently, and vermouth has been around as far as we know for over 8,000 years, and it's just like any other recreational drug. It started out as medicine. So the idea of adding a, you know, fruit spirit, a higher in alcohol fruit spirit, was so that it would live longer, you know, whereas wine oxidizes much more quickly once you open a bottle.
Mm-hmm. I think, like, there's a... Well, just to go into the farm thing. I think it's really cool. I grew up on a farm, and then I moved to the city, and I really thought it was cool and strange to see so many and hear about so many people who were, like, living in the city, where I was like, I gotta get to the city. And then some people are like, man, I gotta get to the farm.
Yeah. It's always, grass is always greener, right? On the other side of the farm.
The wormwood's always greener.
Yeah, so let's talk about the farm. You're known for foraging for a great percentage of the things that go into your vermouth, and they're all different and seasonal. And now you're going to grow that stuff. Is that crossing some weird bridge? Are you still... So now you're growing the things that you used to just go seek out and find.
No,
is that going to change the direction of your vermouth making?
Well, I'm still foraging every ingredient that I would normally forage. I think that's something that we need to kind of get to the bottom of is everything involving something going into a bottle. There's going to be a big element of some sort of earthly manipulation, right? So when I'm foraging, that's kind of like the most sustainable possible practices I can use. Plus, ingredients that grow wild tend to, you know, be more aromatic. They're, you know, growing in the forest, whereas on my farm, I'm mimicking the forest, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm practicing permaculture, but it's still a manipulation of the earth, which is crossing a line for me in a way. But what I can find wild, I'll still find wild. And, you know, things that I was, you know, had been sourcing from farmers in the area, I'm going to start growing myself, with the exception of a few things that are just too big, you know, that I don't have a big enough space for, or maybe the space that I have isn't in the sun enough, or what, you know, I mean, it just takes so many different ingredients, so to speak, or really like mental preparation in order to actually do a good job. You have to do so much homework in order to properly plant and know what's supposed to go where and when you pick it and all of that shit. Whereas when you forage, you're like, well, this is here.
I'm just going to grab it.
You know,
it.
Like, right, exactly. Like, good haul today.
Grab you
know,
it when it's you see a, it, right.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's completely different. And, I mean, the goal for both of those is so that, you know, my ingredients are making themselves, and so that rather than having the stress of needing to source the things I need, I can just walk out my back door and I can have them, whether they're in the woods or, you know, in the fencing of my farm acres. But like I was saying with mimicking the forest, you know, it's not like digging up the earth and, you know, putting in plants. It involves a lot of layering. So you layer with, you know, mulch and soil and straw and soil and more straw and like all of these layers so that when you build these things, they're incorporating better nutrients into the ground underneath, creating a healthier subsoil, you know, which is basically mimicking what they do in the forest. So straw instead of dead leaves, you know. So it's kind of like I'm really just kind of copying what happens naturally and strategically planting things in sunny spots.
That's really cool, man.
That is cool. I guess the question I was trying to get to is I know that a lot of your vermouths have particular flavor profiles that you approach. I remember there was butternut squash. There was one that was apple mint, I think it was.
Yeah, that's the one I brought today, actually.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Good guess on my part. but I feel like your approach before was to go and forage. So it would kind of be like, well, I found this, so that's the flavor I'm going to make. But now you're growing things, so you can plan the flavors you're going to make. Is that more the direction that the...
Well, for ingredients like apple mint, you can definitely find that shit wild. I mean, most of the ingredients I use are weeds or barks or roots, you know. I mean, most of the stuff I'm using you can kind of find, but then there are certain things like, you know, like you mentioned the butternut squash. The butternut squash is a really great example of what the fuck am I going to do all winter and stay in business. And so you have to get creative and you have to use ingredients that are available in New York in winter, which for, you know, a state with not the longest growing season, you know, and especially since we don't have access to citrus fruit and, you know, different things that kind of, you know, that kind of make it really easy to create a plant composition because you can easily get the acid and the sugar you want by adding citrus and actual sugar. And so my job gets a little difficult as the seasons go on to keep plant compositions going and still maintain a balance. But as far as, like, you know, they're not really main ingredients. I'm not using more of one thing than the other. I'm just kind of, like, referring to them after an ingredient I'm willing to admit. Vermouth has always been, you know, a sacred formula. And,
sure.
You know,
shrouded in secrecy.
Yeah. There are only ever a couple of ingredients I'm willing to admit to.
Got it. Well, you've got a bottle of apple mint right there. Are we going to taste some?
Yeah, please.
Crack it open.
I got to go foraging a couple of summers ago in Prospect Park, which was a really interesting experience.
I hope you didn't eat anything.
I didn't.
Okay, good.
I had a flask and a free afternoon. And there's this guy named Wildman Steve, and he's, like, very well known for, like, foraging. And his
daughter.
Have
you read his book?
I have a couple of them. They're pretty awesome.
The only issue with books like these, and I think that Steve is, you know, from what I've absorbed about him, is a pretty wonderful character, but you can't eat what you pick in Central and Prospect Park. They spray more than an industrial farm. Like, it's not food, you know?
Yeah.
It's not food.
It's shell-coated with pesticides.
Like, do you ever wonder why when you're laying on the lawn in Central Park, you're not getting eaten by mosquitoes?
Yeah.
Right. That's why.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're crop dusting the parks in New York.
Yeah, it was a fun trip, but I definitely didn't eat anything. I, like I said, I just drank a bunch of herbal liqueurs and walked around like a freaking homeless man in the park. It was so much fun.
I'm surprised you weren't tripping. That would have been maybe a little more
fun. I never said I wasn't.
Truth comes out. Okay, so we have this beautiful vermouth in hand. Talk to us about it and talk to us about the inspiration. And then we'll talk some more.
So this vermouth has three different types of mint.
It's a talk show.
I often call it apple mint, which is really, like, the worst possible name because there are no apples. It's a type of mint. It's very confusing. But I often use Chardonnay-based wine for this. This happens to be a single vineyard Chardonnay in a very oceanic location on the North Fork of Long Island called the Sargon Vineyard. So it's pretty salty, is really cool.
Yeah, savory.
And, you know, a lot of people are afraid to have, you know, not to say like a real martini, but really a real vermouth cocktail where it's mostly vermouth. And that's because more people are leaning towards bitter drinks and are shying away from super syrupy cocktail drinks. And also, you know, just looking for something lower in alcohol. And, you know, it's a healthy trend that's kind of been happening all throughout not only our country, but many countries that I've visited lately. And so I wanted something that was going to encourage people to not be afraid to have more vermouth, you know, in a drink, particularly like a gin-based drink. And I wanted people to be able to drink something on its own and, you know, still feel good about it. So this was one of the first vermouths I released. I'm on the 15th batch.
Oh.
And
how, you know, the big question, how big are the batches? People love to know that.
So this bottling was the largest batch that I had ever bottled, which was 100 cases.
100 cases.
So I still mean three, dick to the universe. Very small.
Yeah, 100 cases in your bottle size is a 375, right?
So, 500.
Oh, it's a 500. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, it's pretty silly. So I'm still very tiny. But that's how it goes when you're one person and you don't have investment money behind you. You know, you just have to grow with whatever cash you have. And you have to be comfortable with the level you're at because at least you can still handle it.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about that, actually. You're a one-lady show. Like,
yeah, it's a one human operation. I recently have had repeated help, I say, more than once. Someone that, you know, like the same person or two have been helping me bottle, which is like a really big step for me. But I'm still, you know, making all of the vermouth. And then I'm taking another grown-up step and renovating this small house that's on my land upstate for a friend of mine who is in the industry as well, makes meads and ciders and is also a forager. And he's going to be kind of living up there and helping me learn how to be, you know, an outright farmer. It's like I was saying, it's completely different life than just walking into the woods or driving around and seeing what you see. It's a, you know, it's like having a newborn baby. Like I was up this morning with the sun watering plants before I drove down to the city. It's like for real farm life.
Farm I can living. Teach you all about being a farmer. Number one, get sunburns from like half down your bicep, down your arm. Usually just on your left arm from hanging out
the window, the window of the truck. Yeah, that's right.
And then the bottom of your ass cheek from the rip in your pants, right?
Yeah, totally. I have a dog named Spot or Tex or Shooter or something like that.
We had a dog named Dammit.
Get over here, Dammit.
Get over here, Dammit. And learn how to make sure that whenever you're when you're throwing your beer can out the window, you have to make sure that you catch the perfect wind kind of
so that it arcs, so it arcs right to the bed of the truck.
Right to the bed of the truck.
And what bat do you recommend I use when I'm driving down the road in my pickup drunk,
for mailboxes or
mailboxes,
people?
Exactly.
Standard Louisville Slugger.
Right? Yeah, standard Louisville Slugger. Works for everything.
I've already started Classic. Writing songs about rain and you know, freight train whistles.
So you do all of this on your own. So you said you started in 2011, so you're 5 years old.
Well, that was the first batch of, that was the question for the first batch of vermouth I ever made. You know, commercially, I didn't release a batch until into 2013 because we had a little bit of bad weather in Red Hook around the launch of my company.
Sandy. Right. Yeah. That's a little bit of bad weather.
Yep. A superstorm, they think they're calling it.
Yeah.
In Red Hook, we know it as a fucking hurricane. But anyway, my first commercial release wasn't until 2013. But theoretically speaking, my company just turned four.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
But your company, again, is you.
Yeah.
And
100%.
You turned four.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Where's my
This was your
cake?
This was your largest batch thus far. I'll bake you a cake. This was your largest batch thus far. I'm kind of winding around to the question, like, how much have you total produced by yourself?
All the years?
Yeah.
I don't know. But last year I think I made almost 600 cases, and this year, I'm hoping to make also that many. Big issue with this year, you know, there's always an issue, which is why I have 10, you know, so that if I have like a shitty harvest for an ingredient that was crucial, I can make something else that season and not go out of business, you know. Mm-hmm.
You have 10 varieties, is what you mean? 10 varieties of your
Yeah, and last year I made 8 of them. You mm-hmm. know, there were 2 due to weather last year that I couldn't make, and then this year sucks because we had a really early spring. It was super hot the first week in March, and then we had a fucking frost.
Yeah.
So everything flowered and then froze.
Right.
And so most people don't have any fruit at all upstate. It's really quite tragic. There are all the peach farmers, for instance, who can't do any peach business for the entire season, which you can imagine, you know, how much of their livelihood that means. And a lot of people have had to, who are usually more, you know, land responsible, have had to use some pretty heinous chemicals to make sure that the fruit that they do have does survive. So that puts me in a shitty position. And as you guys know me, I'm not one to compromise my own practices. So, you know, that affects my business as well. Wow. So my life is ruled by nature, which means it's ruled by
chaos.
Humans, because humans are fucking up nature.
Wow. And chaos.
Yeah. That's true.
Right. Because also, I don't think we've mentioned on the show today, but you have a source radius that you don't go out of, right? How big is that?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it depends because, you know, some of the grapes will source from the Finger Lakes region, which is pretty fucking far up there. I mean, it's damn near in Canada. Mm. But for all of my, you know, edible plants, which I always like to point out to make sure that they're edible when people are making vermouth, is, you know, not outside of 100 miles. And that would be a stretch.
So 10 products, 100-mile radius, and just you.
Yeah, and that's not counting the 3 vintages of Amari batches I have in barrel.
Right. We haven't talked about that.
Right.
Yet.
Yeah. Is that, how far away is that from
It's
being?
Never being released. No, I want it to age for a really long time.
Never say never.
I know. But people ask me about it a lot. That's why I stopped talking about it, because I'm like, fuck, even if I do release it, I don't have that much, you know? Like, I'm not rich enough to be sitting on that much product. So it's, like, what I can make. But it's local cardoon-based, you know, ancient artichoke. A lot of people think the product Cardamaro is made with cardamom, but it's actually cardoon. And, you know, so I wanted to make an after dinner and amaro, a digestif that didn't contain more than one kind of sugar or even one, and caramel coloring and extracts instead of plants. You know, I wanted to try it out and see what I could get away with making, you know, using my own practices that I apply, you know, to the vermouth. So in lieu of sweetener, Van Brunt Stillhouse and Kings County Distillery sold me a bunch of their used 5 and 10 gallon barrels. And so I used freshly emptied bourbon and rye barrels instead of adding sweetener to the batches. And it worked. So I'm happy about that. And so, you know, I mean, of course, my tolerance for sweets is probably a little lower than a lot of other people, particularly Americans. but, you know, we'll give it a shot. It's going great, and I just don't want to release it too soon and then not have, you know, enough to keep the Solera system going.
Right. Are you tasting it as it goes, thiefing some out?
When I remember to, which is generally like every several months.
Amazing. And you did name it, though, right? A little narcissistic name.
Biancamaro.
Biancamaro, because it's going to be a white. It's going to take on some color from the barrel, but it's still going to be pretty white.
But it's a white wine-based.
Yeah, amazing.
Amaro, yeah.
And made, honestly, you know, I deal in that world a lot, and it sounds to me like you're winding back the clock and making the product the way that it was made, the way that it sort of should be made.
For sure.
And unfortunately, it just isn't anymore based on economics and things like you just described, you know, the chaos that is weather and nature and,
well, and
man.
Well, and the trade system, you know, the trade system is bullshit. Like, it's insane to me that you can buy Mexican carrots in a grocery store instead of buying carrots grown in New York, which literally grow here all fucking year. You know, there are just so many things that take a lot of weight and are sitting on, you know, shelves in grocery stores that, you know, grow several miles away from us. And I think that's nuts. I think that, you know, exotic products would be a little more tolerable for me on an industrial level if, you know, we weren't already like creating, you know, so much, you know, just mileage and shit sitting on trucks for a week and, you know, not making healthy food available to people. And, you know, all of this is stuff that I struggle with, you know, ethically, just personally on a daily basis. And, you know, I need to be able to feel good about what I'm doing at the end of the day, ultimately, you know. I mean, we're all hypocrites, but
we are all hypocrites. There's no getting around it, especially in the, you know, the mega metropolis that we live in.
Yeah, and so I don't grow that big, you know, right away. So I'm looking at a fucking 20-year plan instead of a 5-year plan where people sell their, you know, alcohol companies for millions of dollars. I don't give a shit. Like, I actually like what I'm doing. I want to spend my time doing this every day. I like hard work and physical results, and I can do it. I can make vermouth without sweeteners or coloring agents or extracts or pelletized plants and, you know, sweeteners. Like, I can, so I feel like I have no other choice.
Yeah. Now, we obviously have listeners that are far and wide. I don't think I've ever asked you this. How far does your vermouth go?
Currently, the furthest it goes is Norway and France. Soon to be in 6 other countries, hopefully by the end of the year, if I have a good enough summer. Otherwise, it'll be next year. And I'm in 12 states.
Wow.
That's great.
That's amazing.
So it's small, but I want to be worldly. So, you know, you have to get your stuff out there. And, you know, even if you only have a little bit to spread around, I think that it's better than saturating your own backyard.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's obviously it's working. It's a good slow growth model. You know, I say the name Uncouth Vermouth and people recognize it. So I think it's awesome.
That's cool. Well, they're like that bitch.
It's also just cool,
like, aptly named Uncouth.
It's just cool to see that, like, that it's something that has forever been like a product that sat dusty on the shelf, you know, and not really, like, a very misunderstood product for decades and decades, as far as, like, being in a bar, you know, in the well. It's cool to see that you can come out with these really unique products that, to me, I mean, I get the base of vermouth, but there's so much more than that. There's, like, there's a real art and craft to it, you know? They're totally unique. You know, we're having the apple and mint one, but, like, the butternut squash one is so cool, man. It's so,
so
unique.
Weird.
It's like it's its own thing. It's like it's almost hard to call it a vermouth, you know. But I think that's cool that it's grown to a point where you can take a product like that and then expand on it the way you have.
Right, yeah. And I think it's a testament to your own sort of ethics and ethos that you're so sticking to your guns, and I hope that people hear that come across today, because yeah. I'd like to see people follow in your footsteps. Even people who've gone too far down the sort of darker path, maybe they could turn around a little bit and not use pelletized product and, you know, make a smaller batch this year and sacrifice a little bit of money to make something more quality.
Honestly, I totally get it. It sucks. You have a decision. You can do something cool or you can make money, you know, and that's usually the
rare to the two
line,
cross paths,
you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, it's like I've been sitting on the phone for weeks trying to find, you know, cherries where there was no fungicide, and you know, because of the shitty spring we had, I had to wait several months, you know, I have to wait till autumn to plant my own cherry trees, so I'm probably not even gonna have fruit next year, and I'm gonna be doing this again fucking next year. And you know, I get it, like, I'm so much of my time is communicating, micromanaging, like, you know, I mean it really is far beyond a full-time job, and if I were a smart business person, I would have made one thing, maybe two, and I would produce once a year, not 16. And you know, like, I'm in production all year round. Like, you know, winemakers, for the most part, they're in production and then they spend the bulk of the rest of the year traveling and selling their wine, you know, which is right. Like a really wonderful way to balance your time out and you know, still have something to sell, but for the life that I signed up for, it's, you know, it's just a different decision.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you're in production all the time, and I've noticed you've been doing, I follow your Twitter and stuff, or your Instagram at least, and you've been doing some traveling as well. Are those sales trips, or were
always.
These? Always.
Yeah, always for work, which is great. I love it. It's kind of like, sometimes I feel like I'm in alcoholic prison, because you go on, like, so many trips, and there are just so many events every single night, and, you know, you have to, like, wake up and, like, still try to be pretty and energetic and socially, you know, conscious and not terribly awkward, and we all know I have a hard time with that to begin with. So it gets really difficult, and then when you bring in other languages into play, it gets really, really difficult.
Right.
And you know, so it's been really cool, like a great way to see the world, but there are some days where I'm like, oh my gosh, all I want to do is just fuck off and like go to a museum and not work at all, you know. But there's rarely any time for that. Sure. Not that I'm complaining. I get to drive by.
I drove by the museum.
Yeah.
It looked pretty from the outside.
Musée d'Orsay. Yeah.
Oh, pretty.
Maybe next year.
So do you allow people to come by the shop in Red Hook to visit?
Yeah. No, I love visitors. You can come visit the farm too. And Red Hook, the tasting room, is open on Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 8 p.m. And anything that's currently in bottle is always available to taste. And, you know, I also sell some really awesome wines that my colleague and one of my mentors, who's a natural winemaker in Southwest France, his name is Laurent Cazot. And so, you know, just kind of bringing in some natural wine for the people, you know, having it shipped over in larger containers, you know, hectoliters and such, and bottling them in liter bottles and selling them for only $15, which is like, if you guys, you know, are into wine at all, it's like an absolutely ridiculous deal.
That's
for the
crazy.
Quality. So so it's good. So I have like a few things to sell in the shop, and, you know, whatever vermouth is available, the hippie fucking soaps I make, you know, you can come by and put a nice little package together.
That's awesome.
What's the address of the shop again?
It's 250 Van Brunt Street in Red Hook, Brooklyn, which is 11231.
Awesome.
Cool. And the website is uncouthvermouth.com. Go check it out. You can get all the information about our products. And, yeah, thanks for coming on the show today. Yeah. Thanks for bringing this awesome vermouth. I'm really excited to see what happens with the farm. It's like, That's huge.
You and I need to make, we need to plan a trip and go up there.
We're going to do it.
Yeah, you can film a show from there.
Awesome.
We'll record one. We don't film.
Yeah, that's the reason why we do radio, not TV.
Yeah.
I mean, look at this.
Yeah.
Nobody
wants
guys.
To see this.
All right. Well, thanks again, Bianca, for coming on the show today. Until next week, check out uncouthvermouth.com and check out heritageradionetwork.org for many other programs like this. I'm Damon.
My name is Souther.
And that's it for the Speakeasy. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you. Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.